Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The seizure of the U.S. Capitol this week has raised several concerns and questions about the future of American democracy. Was this a coup attempt? Is this beginning an era of undemocratic actions against peaceful transitions after elections? Is the Trump presidency an anomaly to American democracy? Doug Becker explores these questions and more.
I'm Doug Becker. On Wednesday, January 6, a mob emboldened by the encouragement of the U.S. President Donald Trump seized control of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. While the attempt to block the transition of the government to Joseph R. Biden failed, these events resemble a coup d'etat. On today's show, we examine how authoritarian governments can lead to coups and how much this coup attempt resembles others internationally. Our guests are Nandinal Singh, Associate Professor at the U.S. Naval War College and author of Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups, and Annie Ming, Assistant Professor at the University of Virginia and the author of Constraining Dictatorship, From Personalized Rule to Institutionalized Regimes. Professor Singh, my first question is to you. I described this in the introduction as an attempted coup d'etat. Is that an accurate description, or how would you describe the events that took place on Wednesday?
Thanks, Doug. I argue it's not a coup. Let me explain why, and then let me explain why I think that matters to the extent to which it matters. So first up, I understand why people see things that resemble a coup. It was an illegitimate power grab. It was an attempt to stop democracy from functioning. But there's one critical ingredient which is different here. And that has to do with who's engaging in the action. In this case, what we saw was a rabble, a mob of ordinary citizens, some of whom are right-wing ultranationalists and white supremacists, but still civilians, as opposed to members of the state security forces. Now, why is it that I think that matters? I think that matters because I think the dynamics of the event are very different, depending on whether the leader is using his authorities as a head of state or whether he is trying to use his bully pulpit. And this is going to cut a couple ways. One of them is, this was as traumatic as this was, both symbolically and to all the people who were there, this was not as dangerous as if it had involved state security forces. In fact, as we saw with many other protests, the police are more than capable of handling this rabble, this mob. And they could have done so if they planned for it. And so they're not really that much of a threat that's being posed here. The other part of this, though, is that the threat isn't going to go away on January 21st. It's not going to go away after the inauguration. Because Donald Trump is not using the powers of the presidency, but instead using his bully pulpit, because he's not using the powers of the presidency, but instead using his own personal appeal, that means he can continue to do so afterwards. And that suggests a mode of dealing with him. We saw Facebook suspend his account for the next 2 weeks. Twitter suspended him briefly. If in fact he gets cut, if he were treated like any other American citizen who was fomenting a violent rebellion, he would get cut off from the media. And if he was cut off from Facebook, Twitter, and the mainstream media, he would be left with the Epoch Times, Russia Today, and OANN. And I think that would very much limit his ability to cause the kind of damage that he's doing. So this is why I think the definition matters. The definition contains in it a description, a diagnosis, and also with it a prognosis, a set of remedies. Now, I am not personally hung up on definitions. I don't work on taxonomies. I understand why it is that people want to use the term coup much more broadly than I do. The point is simply whether or not whether or not our analysis is going to lead us to effectively dealing with this threat to democracy.
And Professor Meng, I think one of the reasons why calling this a coup has become so popular is to firmly put in place the president as an agent of this action, that this wasn't something that happened spontaneously, but at least was something that was encouraged by the president. What exactly is that relationship? Because when you think of a coup, you typically think of it as against a sitting president. The idea of a sitting president launching a coup against his own government seems a little bit counterintuitive. Are there precedents for sitting presidents trying to use something extrajudicial against their own government?
Sure. I completely agree with Nana Hall's diagnosis of this. I don't think this is a coup, even though some have made the argument that Trump encouraged a lot of these dynamics. So Trump is certainly not the first democratic or autocratic leader to exhibit anti-democratic properties or characteristics. And I think that what's really important is to take a step back and to reassess a lot of fundamental ideas that we probably haven't questioned for too long. So first of all, democracy and autocracy are not black and white categories. They completely exist on a spectrum. So almost all democracies have authoritarian characteristics, and plenty of autocracies have democratic characteristics. Another idea that we actually really need to rethink and re-examine is just this very foundational idea that America has been a democracy and is a democracy, right? So as a scholar of authoritarian regimes, I gotta say that the history of America looks incredibly authoritarian to me. So first of all, just even by very simple, basic, minimalist procedural definitions of democracy, we didn't even have universal suffrage until 1965, right? So women didn't have the right to vote until 1920, and Black people didn't have the right to vote until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. So even by the most basic definition of having universal political participation, the US at best can be considered a democracy starting in 1965. So we've only been a democracy for 55 years. And I think that we also need to kind of re-examine this idea that we were constructed to be a democracy of, by, and for the people. The founders were elites that wrote a constitution that completely enshrined their own political and economic power, right? It's not an accident that more than half of the population did not have suffrage. It is not an accident that we have things such as the Electoral College, which is a very bizarre way to choose a leader. These institutional decisions that were constructed by the founders were not accidental. They are authoritarian. These are very common strategies that autocratic leaders use all around the world, right? Strategies like gerrymandering, strategies like writing certain types of electoral rules to entrench the elites that are already in power. So I think that we really need to be critical of this idea that America was a great democracy and it suddenly started to fall apart in the last 5 years. You know, returning to this question of how did we get a leader like Trump who suddenly is just acting so, you know, authoritarian now? I think that Trump is maybe a little more willing to be kind of blatantly authoritarian in his language. But as I've mentioned before, we've had plenty of authoritarian type characteristics this whole time. Gerrymandering, the Electoral College, things like that. FDR stayed past the norm of two terms. Presidents have definitely stepped beyond the bounds of power before. I think maybe what we're seeing now is kind of maybe different language and a more kind of willingness to openly embrace authoritarian type identities. Putting these two ideas together, I actually think that what we're seeing now is a reaction to increasing democratization, not democratic backsliding. What we've been seeing is as previously marginalized groups gain more political power in terms of expanding access to vote, as well as previously marginalized groups gaining more representation in government, these previous elites and previous groups that benefited from these kind of old structures of power are being challenged. And so now we're seeing a really violent reaction against that, right? And so I would argue that in a kind of strangely counterintuitive way, we're seeing violent reactions against democratization in the US.
Now, Professor Singh, this kind of creates a little bit of an existential question in my mind, in that you're arguing this is not a coup in part because of the reaction, you know, to the president since Wednesday. but Professor Ming highlights that there are these authoritarian tendencies anyway. So I guess part of what I've been wrestling with is, if it's not a coup because the government's not acting in a way where it believes that it's all that threatened by the president, is it that what we're really seeing exposed is kind of this authoritarian streak that doesn't show the same level of outrage institutionally that individuals are showing as a result of the actions on Wednesday?
Two things. Firstly, just to clarify slightly, the distinction I was drawing earlier was just that there's a big difference between when the military does it and when civilians do it. Now, you're right, civilians could have caused a lot of damage. It's just that that by and large, they're less capable of doing so than the United States military or the DHS or any number of state security organs. But I do think you're pointing at something else here as well, which is the way in which this threat was not considered very seriously. The police didn't plan for it. Heck, even Lindsey Graham said that this was not treated nearly as seriously as the Black Lives Matter protests. The Black Lives Matter protests were peaceful, and these ones were violent. And so you're absolutely right to point out that the police didn't consider this seriously, and they failed to do so even as the protesters left the mall and got closer and closer and closer in. And part of this does have to do with the fact that there are certain segments of society that apologize for authoritarian tendencies or that identify with some of the grievances of the protesters. So if I remember right, the head of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police, a police union with 13,000 people, said, look, this was no big deal. There's a little bit of property damage, a little bit of trespassing, but there wasn't much that went on. And it's an incident in which one policeman was killed, one protester was shot. There were several other deaths, but there was a good deal more violence than that. And so part of the reason why this happens goes back to Annie's point, which is to say, in countries which have a history of authoritarianism, some of this gets taken for granted, and certain kinds of threats are not treated as seriously as other kinds of threats are. On today's 538, there is an article running which talks about differential policing. And they say that the police were twice as likely to crack down on left-wing protesters than right-wing protesters. And this was true even in cases where the left-wing protesters were entirely nonviolent.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the mob seizure of the Capitol building on January 6th and its implications with Professors Nandanal Singh and Annie Meng. And Annie Meng, that is certainly an issue that's been raised, the type of reaction from the police when they're talking about a largely white and a conservative group of protesters versus, for instance, the Black Lives Matter protests. I guess one of the questions I have here is that then, is the fact that that point is being laid bare in our discourse since those actions, do you see this as an opening for a greater level of democratization? The fact that it's pretty clear as a part of the discourse that one of the lessons learned here is who's doing the protest matters with respect to how the police and how any form of security responds to that. Are we going to come out more democratic on the other side?
I think that it could go either way, and it could be that both of these things happen. So on one hand, we have been democratizing more. You know, the Senate elections in Georgia show that mobilization to counter voter suppression tactics can work. That was very promising, right? And I think that it shows that these efforts to continue democratizing can work. And I think that with the fact that we've been getting a more kind of diverse and representative Congress and that elected officials are getting more, you know, diverse and the newer generation are kind of very vocal about these things, I think it is possible that people are just becoming a lot more aware of these things. And I think that it's good both for kind of political consciousness and being politically active and just trying to get a lot more people kind of to participate in democracy, right? Which are all good things for democracy. However, on the other hand, I think that a potential danger and what worries me in terms of not being able to democratize further is that democracy is kind of like this weird thing where I think it's kind of like money. It's this like made up thing that we all believe in and it works because we all believe in it, right? But if like tomorrow we all decide that money is just useless paper, then it completely loses its value. Democracy is kind of the same way, right? We all buy into it and it works because we all buy into it and we agree to vote and not march and break down the doors of the Capitol building, right? And so I'm afraid that this is going to kind of develop norms of political violence. And so if we start to see more and more election-related violence, then I would be really worried about norms of kind of peaceful voting and, you know, these beliefs about democracy breaking down. And I think that that's really dangerous because at the end of the day, democracy is just this idea that everybody needs to buy into, right? That's what sustains it.
Nanan Al Singh, you wanted to respond to that as well.
No, I wanted to agree with what Annie was saying, that democracy rests upon a shared understanding amongst the people. And there are a whole bunch of not only norms, but expectations. And the reason why losers are willing to step down is because they understand that if they win, the next time round, the other side will step down. But if we start to damage the norm that that elections which are conducted fairly, their outcomes are accepted, the consequences of that can be quite damaging. Now, what I'm finding is particularly worrisome here is the fact that there are a number of political actors who know better, right? There are a number of, for example, prominent senators who were very clear in 2016 about the dangers that they saw of Trump's election, who are now backing what is a very specious set of claims about election irregularities. I am sure that Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Lindsey Graham all know better. But they're engaging in this because they're opportunistic. What that's telling us, though, is that the penalties for this sort of behavior are low enough and the benefits are high enough, given the nature of the Republican Party, given the kinds of media discourse we have, it's given the levels of polarization that exist, that they feel that they can do this without consequence. And that is very alarming to me. Norms don't simply reproduce themselves automatically. Elites need to commit to them. They need to observe them. And average citizens need to commit to them and observe them. And what we're seeing here is some extremely cynical behavior by elites that could be very damaging. And I pick those three names in particular because they all made very clear statements about Donald Trump in 2016. And they're all fairly intelligent people. So there's no reason to believe their behavior is anything but cynical and opportunistic.
Annie Meng, since democratization is, you know, is a norm, one of the things that we've learned over the course of these last 4 years, and perhaps as you suggested, a lot longer than that, a lot of these norms that we have held up as relatively sacrosanct really are not. And they can come tumbling down pretty quickly. So for small D Democrats, people committed to these democratic norms, how do we get back to considering any of these norms as sacrosanct? Is the only option that we need to codify it in law? And even that depends on the willingness to actually enforce those laws.
That's a really hard question, right? And the causes of democratization and how to get democracies to consolidate is probably one of the oldest political science questions that maybe hasn't been fully, you know, adjudicated at this point. There's been a little bit of survey work done, and what we have found is that kind of like everyday American citizens are actually kind of frighteningly authoritarian sometimes. For instance, everyday people actually don't rate the importance of checks and balances in government as highly as political scientists kind of rate them or think that they're important. there's kind of a nascent scholarly literature going on right now in terms looking at democratic erosion and how to stop it. And right now I'm seeing a lot of solutions being proposed that rely on kind of voters being like the actor to stop democratic backsliding. I think that that's not sufficient. It's not enough to just hope that voters will do the right thing. Unfortunately, I think that a lot of these problems are cyclical. There needs to be institutional changes. For instance, getting rid of abolishing the Electoral College would be great. But again, these problems are cyclical. I don't know if there would be the political will to do that because there are plenty of politicians right now that are benefiting from the Electoral College who would be completely unwilling to abolish it. I do think that a lot of these kind of on the ground efforts to at least kind of expand access to voting is a kind of really important and kind of foundational step in all of this.
There are a few things that elites could do as well. You saw there was a complete turnaround in the way that social media companies behaved between the point at which they thought they were being regulated by Republicans to the point at which they realized they were about to be regulated by Democrats. They applied their standards consistently to Donald Trump for the first time. I suspect we're going to start seeing some changes in the way that Fox News behaves as well. And I think that matters a lot. But there are other things too. One of the things is that because there's a huge concentration of both wealth and power in America, the decisions of a few people can have a disproportionate influence. And right now we live in a world where when a senator leaves office or when certain congressional representatives leave office, they can move into fairly lucrative circles. They can become lobbyists. They can consult for a hedge fund. They can be on the boards of corporations. But all of these are things that a fairly small number of people could decide not to do. If in fact, let's say a senator had been a prominent supporter, vocal supporter of ISIS, although couched in a theoretical way, he would never get a chance to sit on a corporate board and, you know, earn $25,000 every time he showed up for a meeting. Well, we could treat if we decide that we're not going to let people get away with undemocratic behavior, if we are going to, for the rest of their lives, remind them of the decisions that they made and the consequences that come from that decision, it is possible for elites to impose penalties on people who violate their norms. You know, Ted Cruz goes to his Princeton reunion every year, and he will feel very differently if the people over there greet him as if he is someone who decided to spit on democracy.
Now, Annie Meng, there's another consequence to all of this that I've been considering. That's the U.S. has typically been a world voice favoring democratization, encouraging democratization worldwide. And I know the international reaction to the events this week has been pretty shocking, and not the least of which is this notion that the U.S. has really lost quite a bit of legitimacy speaking on behalf of global democratization. How real is this threat, and do you see any sort of consequences to that?
Well, I have a pretty cynical view on the U.S. as a beacon of democracy, both at home and worldwide. I think there's a couple angles to consider here. So first of all, a concern might be that the U.S. behaving very anti-democratically might encourage kind of like a global norm where authoritarianism is more accepted as a model of government or something like that. I don't know if that really makes a real difference in terms of how regimes are being structured and whether they are democratizing or not. Elites worldwide are going to design institutions in the way that benefit them. I can't think of a country that decided to democratize or not democratize because they were like so inspired by the American example. I think kind of like beyond maybe this just like veneer of America appearing democratic to the rest of the world, if we want to think about kind of like America's democracy promoting agenda abroad, I also have a very cynical view of that. We apply it extremely inconsistently, and we have strong alliances with plenty of dictatorships when it suits us. Like, we're friends with Saudi Arabia. So we're extremely inconsistent with our democracy promotion agenda anyways. Furthermore, there's been a lot of work that shows that democracy promotion abroad actually has kind of like really bad unintended consequences, in that these kind of democracy promotion efforts or things like election monitoring in other countries are often extremely shallow. We basically give a lot of these countries a very crude checklist that's very easy for them to kind of check off on the surface. So it is not a surprise that the average dictatorship today looks like a democracy. That's in part because of these very shallow and superficial kind of like democracy promotion efforts, right? And this kind of global norm towards appearing democratic. The average dictatorship today has elections, has parties, has opposition parties, has a functioning legislature. And basically every country has kind of learned the language of democracy and how to appear democratic, right? And so I think that democracy promotion was already very flawed to begin with. And so I think that these concerns are maybe premised on something that honestly might have hurt real efforts towards democratization.
So we've been discussing the events of this week, the impact that it has on our understanding of what actually constitutes a coup d'etat, the responses to this sort of undemocratic or anti-democratic action, and the potential this could have for democratization worldwide. Our guests today have been Nandanil Singh, associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. He is the author of Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups. And Annie Meng, she is the assistant professor at the University of Virginia and is the author of Constraining Dictatorship, From Personalized Rule to Institutionalized Regimes. Thank you both very much. Welcome to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. The events of this past week, and those since the American election of 2020, were presaged by a president who's shown little regard for democratic norms and principles since his election in 2016. In this segment, we examine the authoritarian slide in the United States under the presidency of Donald Trump. Our guests are Andrew Rudlevich. He is the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. He's the author of Managing the President's Program, Presidential Leadership and Legislative Policy Formulation, and the New Imperial Presidency. And George C. Edwards, who is the University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies at Texas A&M University. His books include On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit, The Strategic President, Persuasion and Opportunity in Presidential Leadership, and Predicting the Presidency, The Potential of Persuasive Leadership. He's the editor of Presidential Studies Quarterly. Professor Rudlevich, we'll start with you. First, is my description of the presidency of Donald Trump as being more authoritarian, more of a challenge to democratic norms, accurate? And if so, how much of an outlier is he from the history of modern presidents?
It's a great question. And by the way, thanks for having me here with you. It's a great pleasure to be with George as well, who, if you had just listed his book titles, we would already be out of time. So it's a really interesting conversation to have, I think, and it's one we're going to be having for quite a while. I think with the Trump presidency, you have a little bit of a split screen, right? In one sense, the use of presidential power, as they've either been handed down from the Constitution or more often delegated by Congress over many years, you know, his extension of those powers, I think, is going to fit into a sort of continuum, right? He was certainly aggressive in the way that he used the war powers or administrative, whether it be executive orders or proclamations, memoranda, or the regulatory state. But I think where we will begin to see the term authoritarianism rightly used is in his attempts to ignore the results of a free and fair election, which is pretty textbook in that regard. But also, I think past scholars have talked about powers and duties of the office. President Trump has used his powers, the executive powers, quite aggressively, as I said, but I think it's the duties where we'll be find the most problematically. And some of those are norms, right? They're not necessarily in law, but norms of communication, norms about interbranch relations and cooperation with Congress, for example, giving Congress information so that it can legislate. Obviously, what you use your powers to do, right? In the case that got President Trump impeached, maybe I have to say impeached the first time. That's a little unclear right now. But, you know, that was the aggressive use again of budgetary powers that are vaguely within presidential purview, but used for something that was quite inappropriate. And so, you know, whether it comes to the president's tone or the president's obviously attitudes towards norms and what we expect a president to act like, it turns out that there were good reasons, you know, not to be, quote, modern day presidential, as President Trump claimed he would be, right? It turned out that modern day presidential meant juvenile. And that's a problem when we're talking about an office that has the authority that it does and that it has built up over years. So I do think there are going to be some places where we say, well, he was kind of like other presidents, except more obnoxious. But then there are others where that obnoxious really sort of morphed into something that was very problematic for the Republic.
Professor Edwards, your reaction to the same question?
Yeah, I think Andy, as I would expect, did a great job. Let me take the ball and run from that. I think this is a very much public relations presidency. Public relations occupied the president's time. It occupied his energy. He spent hours watching TV, most of the morning, watching the news. He sent thousands of tweets. He appeared at scores of rallies. It was all about promoting himself. And I think this is where we see the most deleterious effects of his legacy, right here. So he failed in the short term. He failed in his broad goal of obtaining public support for himself or for his policies, none of which were very popular. He did succeed in maintaining his base. But I think there's some other things that are very disturbing, and it's violating long-term norms. So let me just try to illustrate just a couple of these. First of all, we know that his response to any criticism is to demean his opponents. And I think this encourages incivility. I think it corroded public discourse. That is a long-term problem for the American polity. And that is one part of his legacy. He's refused to carefully evaluate the nature of challenges facing our society. So he's misled the public, in my opinion, about serious threats such as Russia on the one hand, climate change on another. We can't forget the pandemic, which was no problem at all, if you recall, just a few months ago. Clearly the most mendacious president we've ever had, probably by a factor of 1,000. I think this is a problem. He's lied about people, about issues, about nations, about policies, about his accomplishments. Just the other day, he said he was the greatest first-term president of all time there's ever been. Well, so I think this accelerates the use of disinformation, a big problem in American society today, a very big problem. And we saw some of the consequences of it on Wednesday. And he distorted the public's knowledge. When the public doesn't actually have a good sense of what's going on, then it undermines democratic accountability. Really at the core of democracy is accountability, but you have to know what's going on to hold people accountable. He also has employed racially charged language. And I think that has helped legitimize the expression of prejudice and increase the salience of cultural divisions and racial and ethnic tensions. That's a problem in America. We just think of last summer, if we have to think back even that far, but we know that that is a serious problem in America. He made us worse, didn't make us better. And finally, let me just add, challenge the rule of law. He undermined the central pillars of democracy when you challenge the rule of law. The FBI, the Justice Department, they're all corrupt, they're all rotten, they can't be trusted. But also attacking the media fundamentally, fake news. And of course, the integrity of elections. So you're really undermining. Now, this isn't a law that you're breaking most of the time. There's no law, and I don't know how you can actually legislate something about that. But there are norms of civility. There are norms of discourse that other presidents have followed, whether they were liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican. Donald Trump is very, very different. And it's true that most of the people, meaning a majority, which is just 51%, is a majority, means a majority. Most of the people rejected the tone and the substance of the president's rhetoric, but many Republicans did not. And especially for his co-partisans, I think he distorted the public's knowledge about politics and policy. That's a big problem. He warped their understanding of the policy challenges we face and chipped away at respect for the rule of law and the pillars of democracy. That is a terrible legacy.
Professor Rudalevich, it's fair to say something that George Edwards just said was that there's been some degree of repudiation. I mean, if we look from 2016 to 2020 now, the president lost both houses of Congress and then lost the presidency. Is it fair to say that this sort of democratic repudiation of his, whether it's his style or his policies, we certainly have a discussion as to what exactly was being repudiated, but the repudiation, the lesson here is, I mean, what the president did probably is not a good electoral strategy going into the future, you know, for the Republican Party. Is it fair to say that that's the lesson learned?
Maybe a lesson learned at a national level. And indeed, it was intriguing to see some Republicans criticizing the president on the grounds that Republicans could not win a national election, right, in the popular vote without the Electoral College. So they were actually not angry that he was attacking the election, but rather that the implication was that the Electoral College was problematic because national majorities were beyond the reach of the party as it's currently constituted. So yeah, one lesson would be Republican Party needs to be more inclusive. It needs to try to expand to the middle. You know, this was the lesson after the 2012 election, right? The famous autopsy report that the RNC conducted. And then in 2016, of course, Donald Trump won the presidency by effectively turning that on its head. And, you know, instead of expanding to the middle, really doubling down on turnout, you know, of effectively a nationalist base, a white nationalist base. And so that worked, right? It worked against Hillary Clinton. It did not work against Joe Biden. Given the political party's purpose is to win election, obviously that exact model is not going to be what future candidates look to. On the other hand, right, even after an armed, angry mob storms the Capitol of the United States, 100 plus members of the U.S. House and Republican Party voted to support something they knew, I hope they knew, was a lie, right, in terms of supporting the president's claims that there was fraud in the election. Only a handful of senators did so, but even so, that's more than none. Why did they do that? Well, clearly they felt that their electoral interest was, in fact, in continuing the model of base mobilization that the president showed could work, at least localized. You know, there's lots of things we could talk about broadly with regards to polarization and the ways in which people's information stream is quite censored. And this is true, you know, on both sides of the aisle, but perhaps a little less violently at this point, at least outside of the, you know, the MAGA base. I think there are conflicting lessons here, you know, for the party. You are clearly seeing a number of, you know, establishment Republicans, more moderate Republicans who are, you know, upset and rightly so with the direction that the president has pulled the party. As George pointed out, this has been all about Donald Trump, not about party building per se, not about the policies of the party. The Republican National Convention this year didn't even have a platform. Shocking just to think about that in the abstract, right? They did not have a policy platform. The point of the party became to support President Trump. You know, that is a not a recipe for party building or for a party institution that has anything it can move beyond Trumpism with. I mean, so I keep circling back to the point where, you know, yes, it's clearly not a nationally winning lesson, but it could clearly, to the degree that members of Congress and other members of the party think that there are votes to be won, you know, in different parts of the country. We're a very country that elects people geographically, right? So there is going to be a lot of diversity, and clearly this is seen to be a winning message in plenty of places, even if not necessarily as you contest the national popular vote.
Yes, George. Pick up on this just for a second. The president has polarized his base so well that a more moderate strategy, a more civilized strategy, more civil strategy, I should say, is less likely than you might think. The president just met with the Republican National Committee, and they said nothing at all. There were no complaints. They said nothing at all. They just praised him and gave him sustained applause and congratulations. So it's not clear to me that the Republican Party is going to learn the lesson that we think it ought to learn. Because as long as the base, which is the primary electorate, meaning the electorate in primaries, is polarized, is a Trumpist base, then candidates are going to have to appeal to that base. And I think that it was very interesting that the two people who led in the Senate, the two senators who led the charge to challenge the electoral votes of states on Wednesday and Thursday, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, were both candidates or likely candidates for president. And they want to inherit Trump's base. Well, they're not, and they're trying to inherit it in a fashion which pleases an electorate that has been formed by Donald Trump.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the implications of the authoritarianism in the Trump presidency with professors Andrew Rylewicz and George Edwards. Andy Rylewicz, the challenge I have with this is, you know, broadly speaking, what we're describing as populism in a Latin American context, where it really became about personality politics and the support of a specific leader rather than anything ideological. You've pointed out something that has always sort of dumbfounded me, the choice to not have a party platform and instead declare that the party exists to support Donald Trump, who frankly has not been as ideological as others within the party. He's sort of been all over the road there. So how do leaders like a Ted Cruz or a Josh Hawley, how do they navigate being Trumpist with the distinct hope that Donald Trump obviously is not running for president, because if he does, they can't. Is there a possibility of Trumpism without Trump?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't pretend to know for sure. I do wonder, right, if the if merely aping, you know, Trump's, sort of persona is good enough, right? I mean, there's clearly, there is a certain sense of Trump himself, and you see this in some of the almost religious, or sometimes literally religious, devotion that is paid to him, you know, on social media and the like, and even in, you know, the signs that are brandished and the, you know, the role the evangelical Christians have played in his base of support. It's a very interesting question whether somebody else can actually bear that mantle, right, without his charisma, without his ability to entertain, right? And what's been interesting in a way, I think a lot of Trumpism, I was talking to somebody back in 2016, President Trump comes out of, again, reality television, very much presentation of self, even Norman Vincent Peale, right? The sort of power of positive thinking, everything's great, even though it's clearly not so great, right? If you have COVID. And that is, is all about this sort of perception, appearance. And we were comparing it to world wrestling, right? Fake wrestling, basically. This Trump rallies have this very WWE vibe, right? There's a lot of rouse people up, and it's a show, and everybody kind of knows it's fake, and that's kind of part of the fun. So policies are relevant, right? It's about the show. Now, as we saw this week, not everybody quite understands that it's only performance. Right. There's, when the president says fight, or when Rudy Giuliani says this is trial by combat, some people might think that that means it's real. I think clearly Senators Hawley and Cruz were a little bit taken aback by the fact that not everybody was in on their fun game, right? That they could, challenge the tenets of American democracy for their own effectively personal political profit. As somebody put it, they could free ride on others' integrity, planning for the electoral votes to be counted while they got credit for standing up for Trumpism. I don't know that anybody else is as good at that as he is, right? Or that his mantle transfers to somebody else in quite the same way. There has been talk of a sort of, certainly worried talk on the left about the idea that there would be a more competent autocrat who arose, that part of, Trump may have wanted to be an autocrat, but he was really bad at it. He never cared enough about governing to actually, you know, do the hard work to figure out how you might actually shape the trajectory of the United States government. He tore down, for sure. He attacked the Justice Department. He attacked the FBI. He attacked civil servants and expertise and science across the board. But he didn't put anything in their place that really supported him, per se. You know, maybe somebody better at it, it's been argued, would be able to do that, and that would be even more damaging. But, you know, again, I'm not quite sure it works. And the proof will be in the pudding. I actually wonder if somebody, you know, if Donald Trump Jr. is actually the next Donald Trump. He has, you know, not to be too nasty, but no obvious qualifications to do anything else. He doesn't really have any, you know, he has even less political experience than his dad. You know, but nonetheless, he's got the name and the smirk and the attitude. And I wonder if he fits right into that sort of, you know, the reality television side of political campaigning, whether again, that's a majority. I mean, President Trump has never had a majority of the American people on his side. He didn't have a single Gallup poll over 50% during his presidency. He started life, you know, in 2016 with what, 46% of the vote, and he wound up with 47%. You know, it's been this extraordinarily stable support and opposition for as long as he's been on the political scene. So I'm not sure that somebody else can expand that. That said, is there money to be made? Is there political capital to be made in that 47%? Absolutely. And there'll be certainly many contenders for that.
Now, George Edwards, there's elements of this that are decidedly 21st century, the impact of social media, for example, and the sort of media star component of Donald Trump, the kind of personalistic politics where the party really becomes the embodiment of the individual. Is that unique in American politics? Have we had previous presidents or presidential candidates that really did kind of blur the ideological lines and became much more of a personal celebrity rather than a representation of, say, a political ideology or political grouping that we typically would call a political party?
Most presidents have been closely associated with policy views. Some have been more centrist than others, but if you think about sort of notable presidents in modern times, certainly Ronald Reagan was associated with a clear thrust of public policy. So there's a big name. Now, you got two more moderate presidents following him in George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, but they both had clear thrust. They stood for things. They didn't take a lot of stances. Did you say, oh my gosh, that's amazing. That's impulsive. I never thought that they would take that orientation. You know, that's not what the case was. George W. Bush was quite a conservative president, mostly across the board, a conservative president, some as an heir to Ronald Reagan. Barack Obama was a liberal president, as you would anticipate. We can go back to Franklin Roosevelt. So this is the personalization of the party is, in modern times, I think, quite distinctive. Now, because some presidents, let's say FDR, I mean, became so closely identified with the party, but, you know, that you could say it's personalized because he was in office for a very long time, but he really had an agenda, clearly had an agenda, and that's what drove the support for the New Deal. Donald Trump, as Andy pointed out, has much smaller agenda. It's not that he doesn't stand for anything. He does stand for things. We know his orientation on immigration. We know that. But he really doesn't have, when he came in, he said he made great promises about healthcare, but he had no healthcare plan. I mean, there was no White House healthcare plan. There is not to this day a White House healthcare plan. He had an orientation on taxes. He had a few basic things. And he has broad orientation, let's say, on environmental protection. I want to deregulate, you know, I want to deregulate anything I can deregulate. So there's some very, very broad orientations, but you can't identify very many policies. There's no infrastructure plan. If you recall, that played a big role in campaigning in 2016. There is no infrastructure plan. There never was a real infrastructure plan. Nothing has gone anywhere. We know that in the last 2 years in Congress, the president took fewer stands on issues than any modern president. There was nothing there. I mean, there was certainly Senate nominations of judges, what I'm trying to say. So there was that. So that's an agenda. But beyond that, there was basically nothing. He wasn't pushing anything. He didn't talk about anything. When it came to the pandemic relief bill that we've just seen pass, the president was almost completely disengaged. When we came to the defense bill that we just saw, the president again disengaged. He's been disengaged from so many policies. When it comes to the Russian cyber attack, where's the president? The president's disengaged and in denial, apparently. So this is typical of Trump. He's just, as Andy said, he's not really driven by policy. He's driven by being president. He's driven by, I would say he's driven by his need to satisfy his ego. But at any rate, he's not driven by policy. He doesn't wake up in the morning and think, oh, I wonder what I can do to advance policy today.
Andrew Rulevich, sort of last question for you. In the beginning, you said that there is this kind of a distinction between the powers and the duties of the presidency, and that certainly President Trump exercised the powers quite extensively. Do you think the likely reaction to this is going to be a stripping back of some of those powers, or is the expansion of power under the Trump presidency something that's likely to continue and possibly even expand?
In classic political science fashion, I have to say, well, it depends, because I think it is pretty contingent in a different number of areas. So for example, George just pointed out correctly, the president has almost no legacy in legislative achievement. There's nothing, you could look at the tax cut bill, that's way back in 2017. Certainly plenty of judges confirmed, very little else that you would say passed by Congress within a four-year period that has sort of a Trump imprint, maybe a criminal justice bill, but if you want to look for things where the president exercised influence, where Congress passed something that they would not have passed if he were not president, I don't know if there's anything on that list, to be honest. We could think about it more. Congress wanted tax cuts. Congress, especially Mitch McConnell, wanted all these judges in office. They were delighted to have a conveyor belt of nominees, for sure. But, a President Rubio elected in 2016 would have had a pretty similar list of people, probably. So, on the legislative side, not that much. On the administrative side, right, a lot of use of regulatory powers, obviously executive orders, some of which are frankly press releases, but others of which have some impact. Efforts again to shift the orientation of the civil service to politicize it effectively. We'll see again how much of that lasts into a Biden administration. Some of the trade negotiations that have gone on, again, often under the guise of emergency powers, right? And this has been an interesting, aspect of your question. The president has often invoked emergency action, and that's been true, of course, for the so-called emergency on the southern border that he used to move money around to build the wall that he could not achieve, again, through legislative means. It's been true of trade acts, where he's, claimed national security exemptions to keep steel out of the United States, for example, and raise prices, including, steel from the European Union and from Canada. It's been true for arms deals that he's made that Congress has tried to block. It's been true, even in smaller things, placing economic sanctions on the governance of the International Criminal Court, right? How do you do that? Well, you actually declare a national emergency against those individuals. I mean, it's a bit ridiculous if you drill down into it, but all of those are things that Congress over time has given the president power to do. And so where I think you might have some rolling back would be in, what are the president's emergency powers? How long should they last? Are they really the default? Or, perhaps Congress might need to affirmatively confirm that there is an emergency, right? Because right now the law just says, the president can define effectively what an emergency is, and that activates a number of latent powers in statute. There's a lot of discretion in the law. Trump v. Hawaii, right, the travel ban case. The Supreme Court looked at the Immigration Act and said, this is extraordinarily deferential to the president. We really can't overturn what he did. And so maybe you would see Congress pay more attention then to, you know, the breadth of what they are delegating over time. Some of the things, though, you know, for example, the president refusing to give information to Congress, even when he's being impeached, and that became its own article of impeachment back in 2019. You know, a lot of this is up to Congress to have the, you know, the stamina, but also the institutional pride to actually enforce its own rules, right? The War Powers Resolution, the Intelligence Oversight Act, you know, the Impoundment Control Act, you know, all this stuff is on the books already. Congress has not enforced it to any degree, you know, and so if Congress wants to, you know, wrest budgeting, war powers, ethics back from the executive branch, it will actually have to do so. And so the reason I say it depends, well, I don't know what Congress is going to do. You know, we have a Democratic majority. Are they going to stand up to a Democratic president, or are they going to do what Congresses have done for quite a while and say, oh, it's my own guy in there now. It's all good. The next guy might be a dictator. My guy is a strong leader.
We've been discussing the legacy of President Donald Trump, the Trump administration, this drive towards increased power and potential, you know, authoritarianism from the presidency, and what the future may hold in the relationship between the presidency and Congress and broadly with the powers of the presidency. Our guests have been Andrew Rylewicz, the Thomas Brackett Reed Professor of Government at Bowdoin College. He's the author of Managing the President's Program, Presidential Leadership and Legislative Policy Formulation, and The New Imperial Presidency. And George C. Edwards, University Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Jordan Chair in Presidential Studies at Texas A&M University. His books include On Deaf Ears, The Limits of the Bully Pulpit, The Strategic President, Persuasion and Opportunity in Presidential Leadership, and Predicting the Presidency, The Potential of Persuasive Leadership. And he's told me that he's got a new book coming out this year that you should be on the lookout for, discussing the Trump presidency. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.